Exodus this evening. This portion of Exodus picks up the story in Exodus chapter 19 with the arrival of Israel at Sinai. And really, the remainder of the book of Exodus is not so much about the Exodus per se, which the first portion deals with, but it's about the covenant that God made at Sinai and the relationship that was established with ancient Israel. And one of the things we find in this section of the book of Exodus is a detailed description of the tabernacle that was to be built. Now, it is before we get in any further, I want to stop and look a little bit at the tabernacle, because this is a significant matter. There was symbolism involved. We're told back in the book of Hebrews, as we will pick up the account back here in Hebrews chapter 8. In Hebrews chapter 8, verse 1. Now, of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such a high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched and not man. Now notice here, Jesus Christ is spoken of as the high priest. He is a minister of the sanctuary of the true tabernacle. Now the distinction, what makes this the true tabernacle, is it was pitched by the Lord and not by man. What we read of in Exodus was obviously a tabernacle pitched by man. It goes on, speaking of the high priest, if he were on earth, speaking of Christ, verse 4, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law, who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things. You see, the whole Levitical system was an example and a shadow of heavenly things. As Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle, "For see," says he, "that you make all things according to the pattern showed to you in the mount." Now this has to do, as we're going to see in the book of Exodus, Moses was shown a pattern. He was given detailed instructions. And God showed him this, and the reason why it was important that Moses follow the exact pattern God had given was it served to the example and shadow of heavenly things, or to a type. That's the term example here. Coming on, it's speaking of the, goes into the new covenant. Notice in chapter 9, verse 1, "Truly the first covenant had also ordinances or ceremonies of divine service, and a worldly sanctuary," a physical holy place. "For there was a tabernacle made, the first wherein was the candlestick," speaking of the of what we term the holy place, the first portion. "There was the candlestick, the table, the showbread, which is called the sanctuary, and after the second veil, the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid round about with gold, wherein was the golden pot that had manna, and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables of the covenant. And over it the cherubim of glory, shadowing the mercy seat, of which we cannot speak particularly." Now, it goes on to the fact that the priests went into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service of God, but into the second, into the Holy of Holies, when the high priest alone once every year, but not without blood. Verse 8, "The Holy Spirit, this signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest while the first tabernacle was yet standing. It was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices that could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience, which stood only in meats and drinks," or the food offerings, the drink offerings, "diverse washings, and carnal ordinances," or physical ceremonies, "imposed on them until the time of reformation. Christ, being come a high priest of good things to come, by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building. And so, going on, again showing that Christ was the one who serves as our high priest, and that the tabernacle into which he entered is the true tabernacle, the one in heaven. You read back in the book of Revelation several references along that line, and in Revelation chapter 15 we read Revelation 15:5, after that I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was open. The seven angels came out of the temple having the seven plagues. And we see that the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God in verse 8. And this is in Revelation 15. As we read of these things, in fact, back in Revelation in Revelation 11, the time of the return of Christ talks about in verse 18, the nations were angry. The time of God's wrath has come, the time when the nation should be judged, the time when he would give reward to his servants, the prophets. Verse 19, and the temple of God was opened in heaven, and there was seen in this temple the ark of his testament, and there were lightnings and voices and thunderings and an earthquake and great hail. There are other illustrations and examples that we could look at as well, but the point is that there is a description in the book of Revelation of a heavenly tabernacle, a heavenly temple that is described. And we read in the book of Hebrews, chapters 8 and 9, a description of the fact that there was a symbolic aspect to the tabernacle that Moses was given instructions for and that later served as the model for the temple. What you find in the tabernacle, it was a room that was you had initially the outer courtyard. The courtyard measured about 150 feet long by about 75 feet wide. This was the courtyard. And then inside, the wall around the courtyard was about 7.5 feet high. And this was, of course, of this beautifully woven fabric that was stretched on poles and was set up. There was a door. There was an entryway in the front. The tabernacle, which was set toward the back of this courtyard, the tabernacle itself was 45 feet high, or 45 feet long. In other words, it was about one third, just under one third, the length of the courtyard. So it was about 45 feet long and 15 feet wide. And it was 15 feet high. Now you can, you know, imagine as we sort of look, take the dimensions of the room where we are. I don't know exactly what the width of this would be, but probably close to 15 feet across. And then it was 45 feet long, which would have been, let's say, three times the width. It was divided into two compartments. There was a curtain that divided it off. The front two-thirds, which would be 15 feet by 30 feet, the front two-thirds was what was called the holy place. And the priests entered there every day, every morning and every evening. There was a curtain two-thirds of the way back that was a very heavy curtain. And behind that was the Holy of Holies, which was 15 by 15 by 15. It was high. The whole tent was the tabernacle was like 15 feet high. And the Holy of Holies was a cube in terms of shape. It was not large. You know, the whole tabernacle was not large. It was considered the place where God would place His presence. Now, in the back third, in the Holy of Holies, behind the curtain, there was the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat, which had these two golden cherubim carved on it, whose wings outspread, basically filled the width of the room. Inside the Ark of the Covenant were the two tables of stone that God had given Moses on Mount Sinai. That's why it was called the Ark of the Covenant, because it contained the basis of God's covenant. There were also certain things there beside it. The books of the law were laid up beside the ark. Aaron's rod that budded, a symbol of authority. The golden pot of manna was there. Right in front of the curtain that divided the holy place from the Holy of Holies, there was a golden altar. And it was the altar of incense. Then, in the remainder of the room, that was sitting, let's say across right here about the entry of the room, the altar would have sat in the middle of the room right near the curtain. Then, on either side, further out, on one side would have been the table of showbread. It was a table that contained 12 loaves that were changed out every week. And that represented Israel. Then on the other hand, on the other side, there was the table of showbread on the one side, and then the candlestick, or the lampstand, as it technically was. It was one lampstand that had seven branches coming out from it. And the olive oil was what was burned in the lampstand. These were the only three items of furniture in the holy place. As you came out into the courtyard, there were two articles out there. The first, about from the entrance into the courtyard, about one-third of the way back, was a large altar called the Brazen Altar. It was made out of brass, and it was the altar of sacrifice. It was ascended to by an incline of stones that had not been shaped, but had been collected and piled there, and it made sort of a. They came up to this altar, which is where the animals were sacrificed and where this was done. Then, between the altar and the entrance to the holy place was what was called the brazen laver. It was actually like a great big pan of water that was mounted there, and it was from that the priests would wash as they would wash their hands and their feet before entering into the holy place. Now, sacrifices were normally offered every morning and every evening. When they went back, the priests, after the sacrifice was offered, there was the priests went into the tabernacle, into the holy place, and they carried what was called the golden censer, they took. The tools are described in the book of Exodus, but they took some of the hot glowing coals from the firebox there of the altar of sacrifice. After the sacrifice had been offered, they took some of these coals and put them in this pan that was then carried into the holy place, and those live coals were placed in the golden altar, and then incense was put upon them, which caused, of course, these clouds of smoke to fill the holy place and to waft back into the Holy of Holies. And various scriptures show that was symbolic of prayer. In fact, you read about that back in the book of Revelation and other places. That's where the term in the book of Acts comes from, when it talks about the apostles Peter and John going up into the temple at the hour of prayer. it became customary. The Jews understood at least some of that symbolism. And when the morning sacrifice was offered and the incense was then offered in the holy place, that was considered the hour of prayer. It was a time that people would customarily collect in the temple, and it was considered a time, came to be known as the hour of prayer because of what was symbolically occurring in the holy place at that time. And that is the term. Now, this was constructed when Israel was in the desert. This was constructed after the covenant had been made. We find that there was symbolism in the whole thing as you go through it. There was an outer court around the tabernacle. We've talked about that. You know, Israel was separated as a peculiar people. They were to be different than the world around. The courtyard, the perimeter around, into which only the people of God could enter, symbolized Israel's separateness as a peculiar people. They were called out, separated by God, and that was symbolized. The altar of burnt offering had to be passed on the way from after you entered the courtyard before you could approach the holy place. The sacrifice of Christ has to be accepted before we can come into the presence of God. The sacrificial system, we'll go into that next time when we get into the book of Leviticus and we look at the different components of it. But the sacrifices pointed toward Jesus Christ. And first we're called out. We're called out to come out of the world. But if we're going to enter into the presence of God, first and foremost, the Christ's sacrifice must be accepted. Secondly, the priests, in preparing to go into the holy place, had to pause at the laver after having offered the sacrifice. They had to wash. You see, baptism symbolizes a cleansing. We've got to be clean to come into the presence of God. You know, the symbolism involved is that you are baptized, and then following baptism, through the laying on of hands, you receive God's Spirit. Well, part of the symbolism is that God does not dwell in the midst of uncleanness. First, we must be cleansed, and then God will dwell in us. And he makes the distinction of ancient Israel, a people, we're told that God dwelt among them. You see, the tabernacle was considered the place of his residence, and there was the cloud that filled the tabernacle. Now, as you come in past the brazen laver and into the into the holy place, the showbread, the 12 loaves, Israel was to be a living sacrifice to God. You know, they were they were to present themselves in that sense as a living sacrifice. And the 12 tribes were symbolized by the 12 loaves. The New Testament church, of course, started with the 12 apostles. 12 is God's number of organized beginnings, organization. The candlestick, or the seven-branched lampstand, was representative. You know, Israel was not only the nation of Israel, the children of Israel, they were also the congregation of Israel, the church in the wilderness. The church was symbolized by this lampstand, which is the light of the world. And just as there were seven stages to the history of the New Testament church, as revealed in Revelation 1, 2, and 3, so also were there seven stages to the history of the Old Testament church. And the seven-branched lampstand represents, you see, the church, the Old Testament church, the New Testament church, a light to the world, and through the seven stages through which it passed. The altar of incense, of course, was we've talked about, and this represented the what was offered there represented the prayers of the saints. The veil separated off the Holy of Holies from the holy place, symbolizing, of course, that direct access to the Father was not yet possible. Paul explains that in Hebrews 9. And, you know, that was what occurred, one of the miraculous events that surrounded the death of Christ, this great earthquake, and the veil of the temple was rent in two. There was a, in the temple, the temple was modeled on the tabernacle, and it was, you know, the it contained the same articles of furniture, and it contained various things that were there. In the temple, when it was built, this heavy curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from the holy place, there was actually a stone lintel. It was called a beam from stone that actually stretched across, was laid across inside the temple, and it was the means by which the curtain was suspended. Evidently, what occurred for the curtain to tear in two at the time of Christ was, at the time of Christ's death, there was this great earthquake, and evidently the earthquake must have split this stone lintel that came across to where then it would fall, and when it did, it would rip the curtain, which was heavy. I mean, it wasn't just a light curtain as you read about it. It was very heavy and multi-layered that was there. But this massive thing ripped the curtain and opened up the Holy of Holies, which was symbolic of the throne of God, because that was what the Holy of Holies, of course, symbolized, the throne of God. And the high priest entered in once a year on the Day of Atonement, coming into the very presence of God. The ark, of course, represented God's throne, and the cherubim that covered, and these various things that were there. We've seen reference to some of this back in, back even in the book of Revelation. The point is that there was a symbolic aspect. All of these things were there. Moses was told, follow the pattern you were given in the mount. And that is an important principle. God sets the pattern, and we're to follow it. That is something that the world's Christianity has lost sight of. We're in the so-called Christmas season, and people look around and they say, "Well, I don't see what difference it makes. Why don't we do this? We'll do this to worship God." And these people over here, they had this interesting custom. We'll follow their custom and we'll worship God that way. Well, God tells us that we're to worship Him according to the pattern that He set. God has given us His festivals. He's given us His holy days. He's given us a pattern. And that pattern illustrates the plan and the purpose of God. When you stick to the pattern that comes from God, you have something that makes sense. When you start altering the pattern, then you've got a mess on your hands. It's interesting. Some of you may remember back several years ago, the idea, the phrase was thrown around about new paradigms, and we had new paradigms of worship. It's interesting, the word paradigm in English comes from the French paradigm. In French, it's actually derived from the Greek paradigma. And if you go back
and see the usage of the Greek, you find that there were two words which any Greek dictionary says they meant the same thing, just was sort of at different stages of the language. Upodigma or paradigma, they basically meant exactly the same thing. They had to do with the pattern. Well, the interesting thing is when you go back to the book of Hebrews, and Hebrews 8 and 9, you know, that Moses was told, follow the pattern that was shown in the mount. That's paradigm. See, the point is God sets the paradigm, if you will. He sets the pattern. And he told them exactly how they were to do things. You can go through in the Old Testament, you read, for instance, of Ahaz, who was the father of Hezekiah, and he was involved in a conquest of Damascus. The Assyrians actually carried it out, but he was there as their ally, looked at this great pagan altar in Damascus, was so impressed with it, he had somebody make a copy of the pattern. See, same term. Send it down to Jerusalem, get rid of the altar of God in the temple, and replace it with one patterned after the big altar from Damascus. Now, as you read the story, you find God wasn't very pleased with that. Because you see, the altar that they had in Jerusalem was based on the pattern God had given Moses in the mount. It was done the way God wanted it done. And the fact that somebody may look and say, well, you know, that's a lot fancier altar. That's bigger, and I really like that one. Why don't we get rid of the old one and we'll use this one? Well, you see, acceptable worship to God is worship that is according to the pattern that He's established. It's worship from the heart, and it's worship according to the pattern derived from God. And that is an important principle. Now, in Hebrews, or in Exodus, we find the covenant is initiated here in Exodus 19. Israel reached Mount Sinai in the beginning of the third month, which is the time Pentecost always comes in the first week of the third month. Now we're told notice what God told them in verse 5. This is what God had in mind for Israel. Exodus 19:5. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be unto me a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak unto the children of Israel. So, God was proposing a covenant. And if Israel would keep that covenant, they were to become a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. You see, God had in mind something for them. He had made a promise to Abraham that you read of back in the book of Genesis, chapter 17 and other places. And what you find is that God promised to bless Abraham and his descendants, and that was based on Abraham's obedience to God. And now God had led Israel out of Egypt and was going to give them the inheritance He promised to Abraham. But now God proposed a covenant with Israel, a covenant with Abraham's descendants. You see, He had made a covenant with Abraham, which involved Abraham's obedience. He said, walk before me and be you perfect. Become like me. Now, God proposed a covenant with Abraham's descendants. Now, they were going to receive the land because He had promised that to Abraham unconditionally. And He had brought them out of Egypt to do that. But He brought them to Himself and said, in addition, you can be a peculiar treasure unto me. You shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. I've got a job for you to do. You will, in that sense, represent me to the nations and be the means by which the nations come into a relationship with me. You know, that's what a priest does. The priest is the intermediary between God and man. And they were given that opportunity. You'll be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, Peter quotes that back in the New Testament and applies it to us, to the church. You see, that because what we find is Israel did not keep the terms of the covenant. Now, Moses came and called for the elders of the people, told them what God proposed. And they said, all the Lord has said we'll do. Now, God's covenant was that he made with Israel was conditional upon the fact that they would obey him and keep his covenant. All right? As God told Moses to get them prepared, and they would come and assemble before him at Mount Sinai. Then in chapter 20, verse 1, God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. And begins to go through the Ten Commandments. And that's what God initiates with Israel, that as he is preparing now to make a covenant with them. Well, the people, we're told in verse 18 of Exodus 20, saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And they told Moses in verse 19, you speak with us and we'll hear, but let not God speak with us lest we die. So they didn't want God to speak to them again. They wanted to have Moses serve as an intermediary. So then Moses began to give them. Moses began to give them here God's revelation. Chapters 21, 22, and 23 are the judgments and some statutes, but primarily judgments that God gave relating to the application of the Ten Commandments. You know, here was a physical nation, and the principles of the Ten Commandments were the basis of these judgments. And if you notice, as you go through particularly chapters 21 and 22, the operative word that begins nearly every verse is the word if. It's predicated on if somebody does this, then this is what you do. It was not saying that you ought to do all those things, but it was answering the questions that would come up. How do you apply it? What do you do? And so, for instance, if you buy a Hebrew servant, chapter 21, verse 2. Then he served 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. So God set up a system, and other scriptures tell why someone would become a servant. Generally it was as a result of debt, or someone perhaps had been involved in a crime against property, was unable to make restitution, and therefore went into servitude to work it out. This was the matter. As you come on down, we find various details that in verse 16, he that steals a man and sells him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. This is kidnapping. You know, you take someone, you sell him, or you hold him for ransom. It doesn't matter if you had already done that, or you simply were holding him against his will. This is why kidnapping traditionally in even American law was considered as a capital crime. Going back right here, there are things that get into matters of, let's say, the punishment fitting the crime, and the concept, if when it talks about an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. As you go on through the details, what you find is this was a principle of equity. It was the value was there, because as you go on through the story, and we'll see later in some of the other books as details are spelled out, it was not a matter that they gouged your eye out, but it was a matter that there was considered a certain value that was established for any of these things. The point was that the punishment was to fit the crime. It was a matter of equity. And that was the concept, that it was not, you didn't do more and you didn't do less. There are principles here that deal with a lot of things. Verse 28 talks about an ox goring someone and that they die. And if it was an accident, if it was something that just happened, the ox was slaughtered, but the owner was not punished. But, verse 29, if the ox had been known to, if he was dangerous, if he had been known to push with his horns before, and the owner had not kept him in, then the owner was held responsible. The owner could actually be charged with capital murder. The principle was, if you had a dangerous animal and you knew it was dangerous and you didn't keep him up, then that's the same as murder. If it were something that was purely accidental, the animal had never done anything like that before, the animal was destroyed, but the owner was not held liable in the same way. The it gets on down in verse 33, somebody digs a hole and doesn't cover it. It's principles of liability, where you can comes on down where animals get to fighting, and one man's ox hurts another's. Principles of liability and various details. The chapter 22 continues on, has to do with theft. Someone steals an animal and gets rid of it. They make restitution in a certain way. Five oxen for an ox, four sheep for a sheep. If talks about in verses 2 and 3, someone who is breaking in and stealing, and makes a distinction between whether he's discovered at night or in the daytime. Verse 3 is, if the sun be risen upon him. The point was that, execution was not the penalty for theft. Restitution was. Now, in the case of someone breaking in at night and you happened upon him, if he were smitten that he die, then no penalty was taken against the property owner. That point being, of course, that it was dark and you couldn't tell whether he had a weapon or not. You found yourself in a situation you couldn't clearly discern the danger, and that was one thing. But if it's broad daylight and you see him, you don't. He's to make restitution or to be sold, but he is not. You don't just shoot him or stab him or do something like that. That's a different matter, because you can see whether or not he's armed. Then it goes on that makes a distinction. If the animal that he stole is found with him, he makes restitution. He restores double. If he had gotten rid of it, then he can't replace the one you had. Then he has to make even greater restitution. As we come on down, there are various things. Verse 7 on down through about verse 15 makes a distinction about property, and if you deliver something to someone and ask them to keep it, and it's stolen, what happens as opposed to if someone comes and borrows from you? And that's a different matter. If somebody borrows from his neighbor, verse 14, and something happens to it, he has to make it good. If the owner was with it, then he doesn't. If the owner was there, they were delivering it, and an accident happened, then the owner was there and was a witness and was aware and could see that there was no negligence. But so we have just various miscellaneous principles, judgments that were brought out. It says in verse 21, "You shall neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them in any wise and they cry at all to me, I will surely hear their cry." Verse 25, "If you lend money to any of my people that is poor by you, you shall not be to him as a usurer. You shall not lay upon him usury." This is the context here. This is not talking about a business investment. It's talking about somebody that was down and out, and he had to borrow money to buy groceries or pay his rent. If you are going to help somebody out that way, you don't try to take advantage of someone who's down and out to do something. And the same principle about not taking advantage of others, a stranger or a widow or the fatherless. People, there is such a thing as sort of a bully mentality, where people try to take advantage of someone that is maybe not able to defend themselves in the same way. Someone who's a stranger, doesn't know the language real well, is not, has no connections there. Someone more easily taken advantage of. A widow, an orphan, someone that maybe is lacking in maybe knowing some of the ins and outs of what's going on. And it's, God takes that very seriously. Chapter 23, verse 1, "You shall not raise a false report. Put not your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shall you speak in a cause to decline after many to wrest judgment. Neither shall you countenance a poor man in his cause." You're to be fair. And it's interesting the way the Jews applied this principle, because you don't follow a multitude to do evil. You don't decline after many to wrest judgment. You don't just go along with the majority. They had the custom that when cases were being heard before a panel of judges, that they always started with the youngest giving his opinion first and working the way up to the oldest and the most experienced. And the idea was that the younger would be more likely to be swayed by the older rather than vice versa. And it was a matter that you're to give an honest report. You don't just go along with the majority. You're not just intimidated because, well, other people are saying this. But I think this is a principle, you see, of being fair, being right. Now, it's interesting as we come on down to verse 4, because some people have the idea that you don't find any love or mercy in the Old Testament, and that's very false. And the mercy seat that covered the ark. Here in verse 4, "If you meet your enemy's ox or his ass going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. If you see the ass of him that hates you lying under his burden and would forbear to help him, you shall surely help him." In other words, even if someone is an enemy, if you see them in need, their animals get out or something like that, you're to deal with them in a kind way. Goes on into these various aspects of these things, and Notice as we come on down here in verse 20 of chapter 23. Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. So God says, I'm sending my messenger. You're to obey his voice. Verse 22, do all that I speak. Then I'll be an enemy to your enemies, an adversary to your adversaries. My angel shall go before you and bring you into the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and I'll cut them off. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do after their works. You're to utterly overthrow them, break down their images. You're to serve the Lord your God, and he'll bless your bread and your water, take away sickness from the midst of you. As it comes on, he says in verse 28, I will send hornets before you, which will drive out the Hivite, Canaanite, Hittite from before you. I'll not drive them out before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate. But little by little I'll drive them out from before you until you be increased and inherit the land. So, you know, God proposed to fight their battles for them. God proposed to drive out their enemies. Now, Israel lacked the faith to trust God to do that, but God said, I'll send hornets and drive them out. I'll tell you what, you have a gang of hornets come and you're going to pick up and move. God could have certainly done that, and he would have displaced them a little at a time. That was his purpose. Well, as we come on now, in chapter 24, God told Moses, come up unto the Lord, you and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship you afar off. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord. They'll not come near, neither shall the people of the Lord. Now notice in verse 5, he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto the Lord. There is no Levitical priesthood at this time. The whole nation could have been kings and priests, the royal priesthood. Young men of the children of Israel offered the offerings. And the blood was sprinkled on the altar, and the book of the covenant was read in the audience of the people. They said, all that the Lord has said we will do. Then Moses and Aaron, verse 9, Nadab and Abihu and 70 of the elders went up. And notice verse 10, they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet as it were a paved work of a sapphire stone, and as it were in the body of heaven in its clearness. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel he laid not his hand, and they saw God and did eat and drink. So they had this big banquet. It was, in one sense, you know, the old covenant was a marriage covenant, just as the new covenant was. God was the role of the husband, and Israel was in the role of the wife. This could be compared to the marriage supper in that sense. It was a celebration there, quite a remarkable event. These individuals ate and drank in the presence of God. Moses was told to come up into the mountain to God in verse 12, and I'll give you tables of stone, a law and commandments that I've written that you may teach them. So Moses went up into the mount, verse 15. And verse 18, Moses went into the midst of the cloud, got him up into the mount. He was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. In chapter 25, God began to give instructions about the construction of the articles of furniture for the tabernacle. Here, beginning in chapter 25, 26, 27, 28, you have a description of the articles of furniture, of the sacred garments of Aaron, of the tabernacle itself, of all of the various things that were to be constructed. Now, we've already seen from Hebrews that Moses was told to follow exactly the pattern that he was given in the mount. There was symbolism. There was spiritual truths that were symbolically demonstrated through these things. God was making a covenant with the nation. He was not offering them His Spirit. He was offering them the opportunity to demonstrate His law as a light to the world. And He was, through the making possible, let's say, collective worship, setting a certain pattern and style that would enable the people to relate to God and to, with various ceremonies and the things that were set. And then He was given the means of consecrating priests here in chapter 29, and was given instructions about the altars and various other items in chapter 30. Now, in chapter 31, God told Moses who He had in mind to do the various things to construct this. And then down in verse 12 of chapter 31, God told him, He said, "Now I want you to speak to the children of Israel, saying, 'Truly, My Sabbaths you shall keep. It is a sign between Me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I'm the Lord that does sanctify you.'" The Sabbath was mentioned, of course, it had been mentioned to Israel back right after they left Egypt to come out. This is not an introduction of the Sabbath. The Sabbath was mentioned earlier in the book of Exodus. God told them when they went out to gather manna on the Sabbath, "How long refuse you to keep My commandments?" So that was already one of God's commandments. It was reiterated in the 10 there in Exodus 20. Now God is giving additional instructions, a Sabbath covenant, when He said that in verse 16, "The children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations for a perpetual covenant. It's a sign between Me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day He rested and was refreshed." So we find here the Sabbath is a perpetual covenant. It's a sign between God and His people forever. It has a significance that the other commandments do not in the same way. Refraining from stealing, refraining from murder, refraining from lying are very important, but they are not a sign that identifies the true people of God in the same way that Sabbath is. Well, we find now Moses has been in the Mount 40 days. He hasn't been quite 6 weeks. And the people saw, chapter 32, verse 1, that Moses delayed to come down. And they saw that Moses delayed to come down, and they said unto Aaron, "Up, make us gods which shall go before us, for as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him." So the point was that the people lost sight of the fact that it was God that had brought them out of Egypt. Began to focus on Moses. They didn't know where Moses was. And the next thing you know, they began to revert to the religion with which they were familiar in Egypt. They wanted a golden calf. Now, that was the very opposite of what they had agreed to. They hadn't lasted 6 weeks in terms of the covenant into which they had entered. They violated the covenant, built the golden calf, and as we come through the story, Moses in chapter 32, verse 26, Moses stood in the gate of the camp, and he said, "Who's on the Lord's side? Let him come unto me." And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together unto him. And Moses said, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, put every man his sword on his side and go in and out from gate to gate throughout the camp." You know, execute those who were responsible for this. And the Levites did that, and there were 3,000 executions. And Moses told them, verse 29, "Consecrate yourselves today to the Lord, even every man upon his son and upon his brother, that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day." Now this is when the Levites were consecrated and set apart. And the next book we get to is the book of Leviticus, coming just a short time afterward. You see now an entire Levitical system is added that builds upon the things that were earlier given. We read earlier in the book of Hebrews that these things stood only in the food and drink offerings, the various washings, and the physical ceremonies. And that is what was added. The food and the drink offerings, the various washings, and the physical ceremonies. These were the things that were intended as temporary. Now, part of the key on this is given back in Exodus 29. In Exodus 29, come on down to verse 45. "And I will say, I will dwell among the children of Israel and will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Eternal their God that brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, that I may dwell among them. I am the Eternal their God." The point was, the whole concept of holiness was stressed because God, the Holy God, was going to dwell among the children of Israel. And all of these things were given as a means of stressing to the people the importance of being holy, the importance of being, consecrated to God. "I will dwell among them and will be their God." Now, as we come on back to chapter 33, we find that God had had given Moses instruction. The people heard these evil tidings, verse 4, and they mourned. And they were really, realized they were in trouble. And so we find in verse 7, Moses took the tabernacle. This was not a tabernacle that he was given instructions for. This was simply his tent. The tabernacle that he was given instructions for hadn't been built yet. Moses took the tabernacle, pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, called it the tabernacle of the congregation. See, this was different. It had been in the midst, but you see now the people have, by their actions, shown themselves to be unclean. God doesn't dwell in the midst of all of this. And verse 8, "When Moses went out unto the tabernacle, all the people rose up and stood every man at his tent door and looked after Moses till he was gone into the tabernacle. And Moses entered into the tabernacle. The cloudy pillar descended, stood at the door. The Lord talked with Moses. The people saw the cloudy pillar." And they were overawed by this. We're told in verse 11, "The Lord spoke unto Moses face to face as a man speaks unto his friend." So God dealt with Moses in a remarkable way. And Moses asked God for a special favor. And he asked him in verse 18, show me your glory. Moses was dealt with by God. God dealt with him, we're told, face to face, but he evidently manifested himself just like a man. Moses knew there was more to it than this. And so he said, show me your glory. I would like to see you as you really are. And God told him that, verse 20, you can't see my face. No man can see my me and live. He told him there was a place, stand upon a rock, and when his glory passed by, he would cover Moses with his hand, and when I take away my hand, verse 23, you'll see my back parts. You know, we're told that God's face radiates with power and glory. You can't look at the sun. How much less could you look at God in full glory? You know, the sun is a created object. If the sun had put your eyes out, think what it would be to look straight into the face of God as a physical human being. So God said, you can see me from the back, but I can't let you see my face. That would destroy you. That'd be so bright, so overpowering, you couldn't do it. See, God could turn down the rheostat, but Moses didn't want us. He didn't want the dimmed down version. He wanted to see the real thing. And God says, well, I'll let you see me from the back, but that's the only way you can look and survive. So God dealt with Moses in a remarkable way. He told him now in chapter 34, hew out two tables of stone like the first, and I'll write upon these tables the words that were on the first tables which you broke. And be ready in the morning. Come up in the morning unto Mount Sinai. And nobody is to come up with you. So Moses rose up early and went up. And the Lord descended in a cloud, verse 5, and appeared there and then told him in verse 10, I will make a covenant. Before all your people I will do marvels, such as not have been done in all the earth, neither in any nation. And all the people among which you are shall see the work of the Lord. It's a terrible thing. You know, terrible in the sense of awesome or incredible that I will do. So, again, God emphasized to him, I will drive out these nations, verse 12, don't make a covenant with them because they'll be a snare. Destroy their altars, break down their images, cut down their groves. You're to get rid of everything that was connected with their means of worship. And that was to be obliterated, because God knew that if Israel began to mingle in with them, that they would begin to lose their identity. And that's important. You see, we must maintain our identity as the people of God. And so Moses was given instructions, and we're told in verse 28, he was with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights, fasted for that period of time. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai, in verse 29, with the two tables of testimony in Moses' hand, came down from the mount, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. Moses had been here in the presence of God, and when he came down from the mountain, his face glowed, just shone. Well, this was Moses and Aaron and the children of Israel saw Moses and his face shone. They were afraid to come near to him. Scared them to death. You know, imagine he comes down from the mountain and he's glowing. There's this bright light emanating out from it. And we find that finally people came closer in verse 33. Moses, when he had done speaking, put a veil. Until he had finished speaking, he put a veil on his face. When Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he took the veil off until he came out. But he spoke to the children of Israel that Moses put the veil on. In other words, it was so frightening to them, and just Moses wore this veil when he spoke, but when he went into the tabernacle to pray to God, well, he didn't need to wear it in God's presence. Might comment on back in chapter 32 when God proposed had mentioned about just destroying the people. And Moses had pleaded for mercy. And we're told here that Moses besought the Lord, chapter 32, verse 11. And verse 12, wherefore should the, Moses continued to beseech him. And in verse 14, we're told, the Lord repented of the evil which he thought to do unto his people. Now, some look at that and sort of puzzle. The term that's translated repent simply means to turn from. God had proposed simply destroying the people. He turned from that punishment. It's not a matter that God made a mistake and had to repent. God turned from something. He was going to, had proposed a dire punishment upon the people, and he turned from that. As Moses besought him on behalf of the people, God turned from that punishment and did not mete that out. But as we come on through this this section here, and Moses has come down from the mountain. In chapter 35, verse 1, Moses gathered all the congregation of the children of Israel together and said unto them, these are the words which the Lord has commanded that you should do them. 6 days shall work be done, but on the seventh day there shall be to you a holy day, a Sabbath of rest to the Lord. Whosoever does any work therein shall be put to death. You shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations on the Sabbath. And Moses spoke unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, this is the thing which the Lord commanded, saying, take you from among you an offering to the Lord, whoever has a willing heart. And he goes on and begins to describe this tabernacle that is to be built, mentioning in verse 11, and all of the various things that were, talks about all of the construction project, which became the focus. Now the context, it's interesting, you see, God had an important job ahead for them. They were to build this tabernacle, and it was there was a lot of workmanship and a lot of detailed workmanship that was involved. You know, it's easy for people to get all caught up in a physical project. This was something they could really sink their teeth into. Keeping the commandments was a little more difficult, but building a building, building a tabernacle, that was something they could really get excited about. So it's interesting that God preceded the instructions about the tabernacle with a reminder about Sabbath. Because, you know, people can get caught up in doing, quote, the work, and personal relationship and personal worship of God is sacrifice. You don't accomplish God's work by disobeying Him. They were to build a tabernacle. That was very important, but they were to keep the Sabbath in the context of that. I think that is the context of this kindling no fire. As you go through and read the instructions, you read there was to be a lot of smelting of metals, of brass, of silver, of gold, all of these things. And they were not to be doing that sort of thing on the Sabbath. Now, the Jews have taken this and twisted it to the point that they will not turn on an electric light switch because, you know, you trace the current back and somewhere a fire is being kindled. That's the idea. It's interesting. I talked with some who were in Israel for the feast this year, and in one of the big hotels there in Jerusalem, they were issued an electronic key, you know, just like you have a lot of motels, cards, but they were given a special key, a mechanical key to use for the Sabbath, so that they didn't kindle a fire. Well, you know, that's the kind of thing that Christ rebuked the Pharisees about. They would get so strung out with some of these things that they totally missed the point. If you read this in context, it is You know, it's not talking about the fact that if it's a you know, if it's a cold day that you can't turn the heat on, you got to sit there and shiver. But it clearly had to do preparation would be made ahead of time. The Sabbath's not the day to go out and chop a tree down and chop up your firewood. It's not the day to be going out and doing you know, all of those things. But the sense of it here is in the all this about the Sabbath is mentioned in the context of the construction project, and I think that's the sort of a preface to the general instructions for the building of the tabernacle. You know, it was an important job, but it didn't take precedence over obedience. Then more details are given in chapters 36, 37, 38, 39, where it goes through the details of how these things were built and of the garments that were constructed for Aaron and the details of these, you know, these garments that were worn. And it was, we're told that they made a, these were holy garments. They were only to be worn in the presence of God. They were not things that Aaron would wear on a regular basis, but when he came into the presence of God. And over through physical things, it was emphasized to Israel that God is holy. And to come into His presence is something very special. It's not to be treated carelessly or casually. And that is an important principle. And you know, we're physical creatures, and so physical things serve to emphasize spiritual principles. Now, in verse 30 of chapter 39, they made the plate of the holy crown of pure gold. Aaron wore this mitre that was made sort of like a turban, as it's described, but there was on it a golden plate, and they wrote upon it in a writing, like the engravings of the signet, "Holiness to the Lord," and they tied it there on this this sort of cap or turban that he wore, and all of these things were done, and they brought the tabernacle, verse 33, and all of the various things, and so now, chapter 40, the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, "On the first day of the first month you shall set up the tabernacle of the tent of the congregation, and shall put therein the ark of the testimony, and cover the ark with a veil. And you shall bring in the table and set in order." So this was to be done on the first day of the first month, lacking 2 weeks a year from the beginning of the Exodus. They started out, you see, on the 15th day of the first month, and so exactly 2 weeks short of a full year anniversary, they were to set up this tabernacle in the wilderness. So we're told, verse 16, "Thus did Moses according to all that the Lord commanded him, so he did. Came to pass in the first month, on the second year, on the first day of the month, the tabernacle was reared up." And it goes through how it was all put together and all the things that were done. And they reared up the court round about the tabernacle, verse 33, the altar, and set up the hanging of the court. So Moses finished the work. "A cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." And Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation because the cloud abode there. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And when the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the children of Israel went onward in all their journeys. If the cloud were not taken up, they journeyed not till the day that it was taken up. The cloud of the Lord was upon the tabernacle by day, and the fire was upon it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. God made it plain. You see, God was leading them, and they were to follow where God led. And so the tabernacle was overshadowed by this cloud and by this pillar of fire. God's presence filled the tabernacle. It symbolized the very presence of God, and the people were to be set apart as God's holy people, God dwelling in their midst, and God leading them and guiding them. There are many, many spiritual lessons to be gained as we see the principles here of what God did and the way that He was teaching the people to relate to Him and to respect Him and to honor Him. So we have sort of this overview here in Exodus as we come up to this point. We're going to go into the book of Leviticus next time, and we will look and see a theme of holiness that runs throughout. God's plan and purpose is to transform us to become like Him, the holy God, and we must be a holy people unto our God. And that carries through in many, many ways. Well, with that, we will be concluded with what we have here in Exodus this evening.